Press 1 for English.
Welcome to episode 8 of the Miri podcast. I'm your host, Tariq Al-Miri. I'm very happy to share this episode with you, both because it's a special guest, and also I have a new collaboration to announce at the end of the episode. This one is for the freelancers, creatives, gearheads, filmmakers, and creators in general. You're about to hear from a very cool guy, someone young, but with lots of experience and expertise in editing, filming, and directing. He's worked on commercials, films, documentaries, and seen all angles of the filmmaking trade. My guest is Abdelaziz Lemloum, and we chat about how he invited the Queen of England for tea, how he uses Instagram, his journey to becoming an editor, how his plan B became his plan A, how saying no is making his life better, what went wrong with Sotosura Media, the online platform project we worked on together, Gaddafi's smart use of propaganda, the Kuleshov effect, and many more. Ready? Let's do it.
I just feel left out that you've got the headphones and I don't.
It's like the ultimate ASMR. Tariq's ASMR.
Well, I'm going to play this. And tell me what it makes you feel.
I need money. I can't do what I need to do. Sometimes I'm so confused. I don't know what I'm gonna do.
My friend used to refer to them as Africans with internet because they're able
Africans
to.
Africans with internet.
It's a very pushy term, but it's
very.
Because they manage to sort of create a sound just for them, like with interesting instruments, a lot of remixes, lots of collaboration.
I like where they're going with it, but I managed to name the genre straight away.
Yeah,
because it's quite out there.
I think
like,
you can
quite recognize it, like reggae, you know, it's got the instruments that are played in a certain way.
It's very what I do like about them most is their style is their songs are sampled quite a bit, and you can find, you know, features with people in rock bands, people who are doing completely different ideas, but it fits. I don't know how it fits with them.
So how are you?
Very good. How
yeah.
are you?
Yeah, man, I missed
this
you.
This is how it's supposed to start, right?
How like, supposed to start.
Normal conversation. I'm just looking at my notebook.
I'm interviewing
like,
him.
What am I going to hit him with?
With the hard-hitting questions.
Oh, yeah. If you have questions, since this is a conversation, please do. But definitely, man, it's nice to have you.
Good to be here, man.
We go way back. But our connection is very kind of random as well. Like, I spotted your work on Instagram, sent you a message. It's like, hey, let's hang out. We started talking about film, cinema, documentary, ideas, content.
One thing led to another.
We've done a few projects together, but it all goes back to your Instagram. So what
does it? Was it the Queen post? I remember you mentioned referencing that Queen.
I think so, because you managed to tell interesting stories through your Instagram in a way that reveals who you are. You know, it's not just like, here's a picture of me doing something, or here's a pretty picture of a person with their lookalike dog. Like, there is some sense of, like, here's what I'm thinking, and here's what I think you might be thinking as well. But to me, like, who's this Libyan guy sending a letter to the Queen?
Oh, yeah.
And very casually.
Give the audience some
context. So it gave away a lot of layers about you. So actually, I completely forgot about the picture. So take me,
okay.
What's in the frame and
okay, so
with the letter, like the whole story.
I'll tell you the whole story. The whole story started with, I don't know, I wasn't even watching anything relevant. I just thought, what's a cool bucket of this thing to do? It would be like having a cup of tea with the Queen. I thought that was, it's quite an English thing as well. Like, really, like, looking back,
it is the English thing.
What would be great to just have a cup of tea with the Queen? Wouldn't that be the ultimate story wherever you go? I've done this, or like, I had a cup of tea with the Queen, you know, you just... So I looked up the address, quite easy, Buckingham Palace. It wasn't that hard.
Did you have to Google that?
I did. It wasn't, it's quite a, I can't remember.
Oh, the mailing address.
The mailing address. But
she,
it was quite,
she could have had a P.O. box somewhere.
No, there's no P.O. box, Buckingham Palace. And then the postcode was like kind of this numerical number that was just so perfect. And I said, I appreciate you're busy, but
really
something in that, in the lines of that. And I said, do you want to have a cup of tea? I'd love to have a cup of tea with you. And, I sent it. I actually sent it, put a stamp on there, did the effort, walked to the post box, done everything.
Did you introduce yourself? Any context of who you are, what you do?
Probably not. I just said, I just want a cup of tea.
My name is Abdulaziz.
My name is Abdulaziz Amnoum.
If you're available.
I'm, yeah, if you're, you know, it'd be great to have a cup of tea with you. Months go by, but no reply. And then I do get a reply. Obviously, me reading the letter, she go, obviously someone else writing for her. We really appreciate you writing for the Queen. And unfortunately, she's really busy, but she wrote to tell us thank you for even asking. And I thought that was just great. I'm like, that's perfect. That's all I wanted to hear.
you felt recognized.
For a moment, I've got this kind of envelope when I was kind of, wow, I got like, this is from Buckingham Palace, this cream paper. And when I look up, I was like, it's a second class stamp. It's not even a first class stamp. I thought she owned the postal system. Turns out the Royal was privatized, I think. So anyway,
Is that why it took her a month?
And more into my research, turns out before it was privatized, it used to be first class stamps. Now she has to pay for her own stamps, I presume.
But it's amazing though. Like, it's, to me, it tells so many things about you. I don't want to use the word like ridiculous, but spontaneous. Because it is a ridiculous idea to think about, but at the same time, it's so interesting. Would this work? She might say yes. Like, this opportunity of like, if you don't ask, as you said, you'll never find out. So you're a risk taker. You're creative at the same time, because most people would have, I don't know, in this day and age, would have tweeted or Facebooked or sent a video. Like, there's a guy that's trying to get The Rock on his podcast, and he put a domain website, and he's trying to put a hashtag. And so far, The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, the wrestler, the actor. So you actually use the medium that she would use, which is writing letters, because that's very queen-like.
I think that just says more about me, to be honest.
You're very outdated.
I'm very much pen and paper.
For someone your age. And,
yeah.
But it must be so rewarding, because I bet you no one in your family or friends or people that know of you have even thought of that idea.
You know? Maybe they have. Maybe it's something you think, maybe it's like a fleeting thought. By the way, the only reason like I've done that comes back to some of the photography I do. You know, I shoot people portraits, right?
Yeah.
And what I've realized is, just asking, if you don't ask, you don't get. It's just as simple as that. So asking, saying, can I take a picture of you, can I film you, and then the more I started directing, or the more I'm on set, and what the confidence kind of grows.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize you don't mean harm with anyone. Actually, it's a compliment. You know, you want to work with somebody, you want to take the picture, you want to have a cup of tea with someone, you want to go out for a drink, you know, that's kind of thing. And people love that. And you do. I think that's where the confidence came in.
What if she said yes? Like, what would have that been for you?
I mean, that would be amazing. I just think I would be like, wow, it works.
What would the conversation be like? Like, what do you think the common ground would be?
It would be the most awkward conversation. It's like, the most unlikely people in a room, you know, this Libyan, you know, dude and this English royalty.
If you were to introduce yourself to an audience, you're just walking into a room, you're the speaker, this is sort of the 2 to 5 minute, who is Abdulaziz?
2 to 5 minute, oh my God.
Yeah, it's just super brief, because you have a lot to talk about, but like, you want to gauge them into who you are, what you do, what you think, that kind of thing.
All right, skip all the shenanigans. My name is Abdulaziz Amnoum. I'm a director and editor by trade. Libyan, British Libyan, lived in Egypt half my life, the other half in London. Go to Libya every summer, or used to before the revolution anyway.
Cool. What are you making at the moment?
At the moment, I've signed an NDA, so I probably can't talk about that. Non-disclosure agreement.
You probably shouldn't have mentioned that, because that makes it exciting. It's like,
does it? It really isn't.
I know. Interesting. So filmmaking It's quite a vague word, right? Like, especially now with the sort of the variety of cameras available, lenses, cheapness of it and all of that, every other person you probably meet online is asking you something. How do you do this and how do you become that? And
filmmaker is kind of a
vague word, but is there a way to narrow you down? Like, are you a filmmaker with experience? Are you a filmmaker that's obsessed with this? What's the ultimate goal of your filmmaking journey so I can see Abdulaziz in a more distinctive light? Yeah.
I mean, I think ultimately I'd like to direct. I don't have one thing I'd like to. I'd like to make films. I'd like to make commercials. I'd like to make content people watch that says something. I think that's the ultimate thing I want to do. I mean, I think that comes down as an artist. If you're an artist, you want to create something people can relate to or mean something to. But at the moment, it's stepping stones and, most importantly, paying the bills.
The idea of paying the bills, yeah, it's an interesting concept nowadays, especially with the flourishing array of what you could do with video content, commercials and all of that. Within that, what do you do and what do you enjoy doing? Which bit of paying the bills actually is still interesting for you and which bit is just paying the bills?
I mean, I'm in a very lucky place. I mean, everything I do, as much as it pays the bills, I love what I do. So I'm in a great place. I mean, I didn't start off there. I mean, I edit and I love editing. I fell into editing not by accident, it was kind of a stepping stone also to make money. But the more I did it, I was like, whoa, this is great. I'm doing something here. I'm putting things together. I'm telling a story. And it feels like I've got so much control in my hands. And especially if you're growing out and you're not a director, and just the idea of storytelling, being an editor is great.
How did it start? I know bits of the story, but if you take me to the early days of where you're always fiddling with computers and you thought, oh, I can edit coincidentally, or were you fascinated with film and then you took film school courses? Like, what's the entry point to Abdulaziz now?
I've always been into making little videos when I was a kid, and I'm sure you were, you know, just grabbing a camera and doing stuff like that. I always wanted to be an architect, and I think I remember getting the grades for architecture, and I was in Cairo, did a high school diploma there, and I decided to just do that. Anyway, graduated, went to one of the universities, and they were like, you're too young. Come back next year. I'm like, I'm not waiting another year. The revolution just kind of happened and stuff. And actually, a really important point during the revolution is when I really got into media, because I was helping out with the Rebel TV stations. I was kind of really exposed to all the sides, different people, and really seeing the power of media beforehand. And I'll come back to that later. But then after I came back, I think the revolution kind of died down a tiny bit. Went to Egypt and they said, nope, went to the UK. And my dad, Baba Gully, you know, you could do film. You don't have to do architecture. I'm like, I can. And then that just my thoughts just went, yeah, I can. I know already how to do. I'm already ahead of the game. And this is something I love. I can do what I love. Why not?
So plan B became plan A? Or yes. It was never a plan?
Plan B was just always kind of a plan A in back of your head. It's like, I always wanted to do this, but it always seemed like a fantasy. Something about being in London.
And how did you start in London? But how did you pull the rope of... You know.
Start working here. It's who you know, friends who are already after university or people I've made connections with, kind of like, oh, he knows how to edit, you know, they'll bring me in. And it's just finding one job and like proving yourself, really doing a really good job and then making the connections. It's who you know, because if you do a really good job, people will recommend you and then you get more chance to prove yourself.
I mean, it takes me to something very interesting. And in filmmaking in general, there's no straight path to the learning element of it. There is the business side of it, which you network, you meet people know you, they find out what you're able to do, and then gets you the one job and the next job. But how does the learning happen? How do you know, how do you start from being able to cut a trailer to a scene, from a scene to a commercial to this and that? How did you learn all of this stuff?
I think time, you got to keep doing it and practicing, and it's like building a vocabulary, or it's a whole way of thinking, editing, and you get better at it the more you practice it. Like, as with anything, just such a natural thing with anything. The more you do it, the better you become more fluent at it. And I'm still learning. I have so much to still learn. I know that. I think the more I know, I don't, like, there's more stuff I don't know yet.
I don't know if you're ever at that stage where you're like, oh, okay, this sounds exciting. I want to work at this company or I want to do this job, but I'm not 100% sure I can pull these elements off, or, you know, this aspect of it.
Being unsure about what I'm doing there or if I can pull it off.
Yeah.
What is like one thing we all have on our phones? What can we all do? We can all Google, right? And yeah. I mean, and I'm being funny. I know, like, you know, just say yes to the job and learn it.
Mm-mm.
And it's such a good driver. And I would take on a job, even though I know I can do it. But some stuff I'm kind of unsure of, yes, I'm going to use that to just learn, you know. Never lie. I would never lie, say I can't.
So that's actually your motivation. It's not. Yeah. It's not something you that scares you or something that makes you panic.
No, I mean, it's great. It's like there's different types of nerves, and that's kind of the good, you know, good nervous, good exciting, like, you know, kind of you can feel it in your fingertips, you know, like kind of a bit of anxiety there. But it's the good anxiety. You probably never heard of a good anxiety, but you know.
It's fear, but you know, we all fear what we don't know. But yeah. Sometimes there's fear that's not life-threatening. There's fear that is not exposing or dangerous. There's fear because we're like panicking about the loss of control or the panic about an experience we've never had before. So we don't know what to do.
Absolutely.
But that is the good fear, because once you go through it, done. You know what? You know how to do it next time.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm all for just going in the deep end.
Instagram, if we go back, what's that like now? Like, what constitutes a worthy frame, story, post? What does your feed look like? What are you obsessed with these days?
My Instagram is just full of my obsessions as people, just filming up people in the street, stopping them, taking pictures of them in different places, really interesting people.
Why people?
Well, I just love people. There's so much character to people. They all have a story. Everyone has a story. The most interesting people, the people I stopped in the middle of the street, you know, can I take a picture of you? And after I take a picture of this cool dude, gangster, and he goes, what's your name? And he goes, James, they know about me. And he just walks off. I'm like, what? This is amazing. He doesn't care. He doesn't care where the photo goes. He just walked off and goes, James, they know. And
they know about me.
One day, they'll be like, I'm sure someone's going, oh, that's James.
It's people like you that gives him the time and
you
take
reckon,
pictures.
Give the attention.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What was he wearing? What was so particularly
he was wearing,
interesting
actually,
about James?
Of all, I know I say take pictures of people who are quite loud with their clothes. He was actually kind of average looking dude, but he was wearing this kind of hat backwards, and he had like a cigarette he's rolled up terribly. I think you can see in the picture. And there was just this lovely pink tree behind him, and it was just quite a nice contrast, kind of this kind of floral pink thing,
peaceful,
kind of gritty, kind of cool dude, and it was quite
so
like that bounce.
Peaceful, beautiful pink nature, calmness, and then James.
And then James, you should know him. You know James.
Do you want to do the Kuchlov effect? Like
yeah,
you had
yeah,
an
yeah.
interesting story of
the Kuchlov effect.
It sounds
yeah.
very simple, but it's very interesting visual story yeah. way.
I think it's Kuchlov effect. I can't remember. The OG of editing, let's say, kind of understanding editing and the power of editing in something we can kind of visualize ourselves. And he did this experiment where he had a couple of shots in his library, like a shot of a man just looking straight at the camera, just right down the barrel, no reaction, just a straight face. He cut that with a shot of a baby, and then he cut back to the same shot of the man. And he showed that to an audience of people in the film. And people said, oh, wow, it looks like the man is looking at a cute baby. He's reacting. He's thinking the baby is cute. Just by showing an image of a man, cut to a baby, cut back to a man. Took the same shot of a man, just looking straight down the camera, no reaction. This time, he cut it with kind of a woman in a kind of a seductive kind of stance. Or I think that was Hitchcock. That was Hitchcock's version. He brought like a woman kind of like in a kind of a, you know, kind of an alluring moment. And then cut back to the guy. And just by seeing that kind of shot of man, shot of woman, shot of man, it made the man look creepy. And he did the same thing again to a different audience, except he didn't cut with a woman or a baby this time. This time he cut it with a coffin and then back to the guy. He put that in the film and people said, wow, that guy looked really sad, you know? So he went from being a pervert to a person who loves kids to a person who's sad. You got all these kind of, you know, mindsets with just cutting between the same shot to an object. And it's kind of how propaganda works, you know, you give people reason to latch onto a shot. And I thought that was amazing, you know, seeing how you can, it's so simple, these tools are simple. And the more you study them, the more you experiment, the more you hold the shot for longer, you keep it shorter, keep stuff away from the audience, you know, tease them with some shots.
It takes me to an interesting point of constantly thinking of who's watching this, who's the audience. Does it matter who's the audience, or does it matter that you are thinking of an audience and they're all going to relate the same? Or is your audience kind of specific depending on the project? Long story short, do you imagine the audience and how they look like, where they're from, how they feel in your room as you cut every time?
Yeah, you have to. It's a big part of the job. Depends on what you're editing. If I'm doing something for kids, I've done, you know, TV commercials with kids' toys. you watch them as an adult, this is probably cheesy. But for a kid, it's like, wow, My Little Pony. She has the dad has a My Little Pony tail. You know, like, for a kid, so it's like, whoa, that's so magical. For a girl, like, can't believe the dad has a My Little Pony tail.
Is it like a, like an actual toy?
Or yeah, something they had some merchandise with another company.
The voice is just amazing, the way you've done it.
Wow, it's a magical horses.
Did you do the voiceover?
No, we actually hire someone for that, believe it or not, better than my voice. And what I was trying to say, I do a lot of kids' commercials and they are a whole different mindset. And you want to step back and think of it, you know, you're not being serious. You're trying to entertain, you're trying to say something. And completely different with adults. If I make a little documentary or I'm trying to hone in on a point, respecting the adult's intelligence. You know, let them figure things out on their own.
We have a common audience that we produce stuff together. We have an experience of working together. Soto Sura.
Yes.
On paper is a Facebook page, a platform, but the reality is us spending time thinking of ways to tackle issues and ideas in the form of anywhere from 1 minute to a couple of minutes of video.
Content that we thought was just appropriate to say, wasn't
it? It's a mix of documentary style, cinema. We shot a few things with the Red camera that you had under your hand.
Let's not talk about that.
We use your scouting skills and my shout out skills to call a bunch of Libyans last minute. They showed up in a random location. Let's just do this. So we have an experience of working together.
We have.
And I wonder what, if you go back and reminisce and sort of with the hindsight of, you know, growing out of it many years later and having the experience of looking at the positive and negative from that phase
of that period we had.
And at the same time, the distance of not working together for a long time, what was interesting, what was fun, and what was really, really, really unbearable and shit. And you're like,
well, I could tell you
hate you
shit
for this. So basically, lessons learned, good and bad.
I don't know how much of your viewers know about Soto Sura, but it's a project that we did. We worked on together. We made all this great content and it was a really good experience. It was a starting point of something we were playing around with and it was something that was going to get bigger, but it was a great platform to just do whatever the hell we wanted to an audience who hasn't seen that kind of content being made. We look back at it now, it's like obviously not the best material, but we just were just wanting to kind of just put...
I don't know what he's talking about. It's epic.
It was great epic material. Epic, it's really good stuff, material, mate. Actually, you know, some really good things in there. It was the start of something with a lot of potential, and we knew what we needed to give it that extra oomph to be something. And because of the realities of life, we weren't getting paid to do this. We had to do it on our own time. And we know to do anything well, you need money and time. We didn't have the pleasure of that because, you know, we're all trying to work. We all, you know... And that's the reality of life. Even if, you know, we're not millionaires, we're filmmakers, we're artists. And that's kind of, you know.
No, it's valid because obviously it's a chicken and egg situation, right? Like most people write, plan out, wait years, pitch this, pitch left. And you and I like shared the same frequency of like, well, I have this gear and I have that idea and I have the internet. I don't want to wait for someone's email response in a month's time of a yes or no. I just want to go for it. So this is where it started. We're like, we had the energy to ignite the flame, but we didn't have enough to carry it through.
I think we had so much ambition that it grew to the point where we were really confident it was going to go somewhere, and it was.
If I were to do it differently, I would just do one segment that's repeatable, doesn't take so much time. But it has the sort of the ability to engage an audience, you know. That takes me naturally to a place that I think you are at now, which is you are much more able to say no than you ever was before.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you enjoy saying no?
I love saying no.
So what do you say no to?
That makes me sound like a bad person, just saying no.
No. That means like you're a person who is clear about how they want to spend their time and with whom and doing what.
I think a lot of it has to do with when I started my career, just saying yes to everything. Yeah, I want to do this, I want to do that. And now I'm confident with what I can do and my skill set. And you think it's just saying yes and just making everyone happy. But actually, that's not the case. Sometimes just taking care of yourself, saying no, this doesn't interest me, or I found there's a lot more respect to you saying no. People find that respectful because, okay, he has certain standards. This is the kind of way he operates. If you say no to something that's in your way, it's okay. It's not the end of the world, really.
Is the word no making your life better?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's making life better for other people too.
What fascinates you about Libya in the context of media? What is something that you think is really interesting to highlight in terms of Libya, Libyan history, propaganda, media?
The Libyan revolutions when I was 16 is when I really saw the power of media firsthand, because it's propaganda left, right and center. Even though people are trying to tell the truth, someone was trying to say this is the bad thing because they're being hurt or one way or another. And after I went into uni, I started realizing, looking back, how smart, you know, the propaganda was from TV stations that were over there. I think I was really surprised by the Gaddafi's regime, because when I was a kid, you watch the Jamahiri and like, you have stuff that's like, oh my God, a 6-year-old could do this on their phone. This is so terrible. And I'm like, I was telling my mother, like, I could do this. And she's like, yeah, yeah.
Like, what kind of stuff in particular?
Like these weird star dissolves or these whites or these kind of crap music that's always peaking and it's just the same shots that, you know, the desert, and like, it looked very 80s. It looked like it was something of a time capsule, and it was 2010. It was like, it's fine when I was a kid, but then people have moved on. They're like, there's new talent out there. When it was the revolution happened, suddenly so much good content's come out, and some don't have to use a camera, a good skill set. People are making good content. Like, where was this before? People with ambition, they could have worked in these fields. Until I realized it was actually done on purpose. When we were at the rebel TV stations and the rebels were invading, you know, the Gaddafi side of the TV stations, and they were like, wow, they had the state-of-the-art equipment. It was a conscious decision to play things like as they were in the 70s and not move on. To get something to look a certain way, that took effort. You know how we would try now.
So they basically froze time.
They basically figured out how to freeze time. I mean, that's exactly what's happening then. It was just, we want the audience to look a certain way. We want the culture to perceive.
So you had a real appreciation for the mastery and art, for craftsmanship.
So
and the talent.
This is where it gets really.
It wasn't a joke.
No, it wasn't a joke.
The joke was on you.
The joke was on me. I wrote my whole dissertation about the propaganda on Gaddafi's regime. Basically, what Gaddafi has done, he's kind of gave the country a certain look to the West. It was really smart propaganda because it made the West think this is what Libya is like, until Nabus, Allah Yarhamah, kind of like, no, this is what's happening. And I was like, oh, of course, yeah. You know, wake everyone up. And the country was like, oh yeah, that's so true. It's a wake-up call, you know. It's not all,
we're not stuck in the 70s or 80s.
Yeah, basically. I mean, no. I don't care who you're with, which side. I'm not trying to get on anyone's foot here, but I'm just trying to say it was, on everyone's side, it was propaganda.
So question, like, were these suits tailor-made to look disgusting? Because the image is stuck in my head, the guy reading the news, yeah.
Man, these, they don't know, yeah, I think they just wore them on their own, I think, on their own one accord. I don't know much about what their creative decisions were.
I'm trying to pitch this whole idea of, you know, living a meaningful life, living a better life, or making the world around us better in a way. So if you were invited to speak on a platform similar to TED, big, somewhere fancy,
me on the stage,
in California, instead of 500, is 2,000 people.
Wow, the crowds are getting bigger.
The requirement here is the topic that has nothing to do with your specialty or focus.
So I go with my life motto is, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. I think I live by that every day, and that's kind of made me progress to where I am. And with anything, I just want to keep on learning, keep on knowing, you know.
It's not necessarily about routine. It's about the learning aspect of things, you know. Like if I've accomplished everything and I'm just on repeat, then I don't know. I just, something about that makes me feel sad. It makes me feel not excited to start the day there again. Might be in the same place, same people, but doing something else, doing something different, you know.
I think it goes well with our filmmaking kind of.
Definitely. And now I'm at a phase where I'm building routines for the things that I like. So I like this. I like podcasts with people that I like and have ideas, people that I know that are doing some things that are really interesting to me, and I'm assuming a lot of people that are watching this. So there's a routine for this where I meet someone, I engage with them, mm-hmm. and pitch them the idea of the podcast. If they love it, I'm like, done, Friday, this yeah. time, let's shoot. This is what's happening to you
right
now.
I'm here.
You're stuck. You know, you're spending your Friday with me.
It's the best kind of Friday. What are you talking about?
There's another podcast that I'm producing, which happens to be my wife's, that's booked on a Tuesday, and I edit the next day. Mm-hmm. So there
great
are...
Great podcast, by the way.
Thank mm-hmm. you so much. Libby Matters. Subscribe.
Subscribe, guys.
Everywhere you listen to podcasts. There's no video element. Sorry. You're doing a lot of plugins. I like that. I've never done this before. So the
you're
idea
welcome.
Of routine is fine. Because it works, because I know on that day, Tuesday, oh, podcast, I need to get the equipment, set them up, prep them, and then, you know, shoot a rush. It's predictable.
Yeah.
But the ideas,
no, they're
the
not
style,
the same. They're not the same.
They're not the same. They're different. And also the types of jobs that I'm interested in. Like, for example, someone called me the other day. They want to learn how to do filmmaking in order to build their own online presence. What's the one or two things that you're working on? That's personal at the moment.
I have my own company now. It's just started, so I'm trying to take care of that, trying to grow that. Clients come up to us with certain ideas or projects and hope they can entrust us with their vision or our vision that we can provide or make better.
Oh, cool. You mentioned you had a few clients already.
Yeah, there's a friend of mine called Omar Kamau. He's a musician who, actually, a cinematographer friend, Libyan, who's introduced me. Sofiane. Yeah, yeah. He knew him first and they introduced me, and then I did a few things for Omar through him. And then once I had my company, I told Omar, next time you have a project, come to me, to my company. And I explained the whole idea, and he trusted us. Cool. How do you want to end the podcast?
I think I end it just like that.
Just like that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right, good speaking to everyone.
Done. Thank you. Okay. See you later.
Assalamu alaikum.
This was this week's episode. This is Tariq, your host. I have an announcement for you guys. In January, I will launch a new stream of content that Abdulaziz will edit and produce. It's going to be long-form video content, which some of you requested. It is an opportunity for the real fans of the podcast to become members. I will share more details on this as it takes shape in the next month. If you're interested, feel free to get in touch. Thanks for those who joined the newsletter email list last week. You can still make the list to get tips, news, and special updates. Just go to tariqelmeri.com, that is tariqelmeri.com, and hit the subscribe button on the top right corner. Please send a thank you message to my guest Abdulaziz for his time, valuable ideas, and honesty. I look forward to your lovely messages about this episode. Stay tuned for next week. You'll be listening to...
I love the first one. You interviewed yourself? I think it was genius. لأنه بالنسبة لي أول مرة نشوف حد يدير مقابلة مع نفسه. حبيتها لأن مرات الشخص محتاج يتعرف على نفسه.
This is it. See you next week.